try to run, but you can never hide. I like the mountains. We always get our man. We're not the mountains. We're handsome.
We're brave.
We're strong. We're not the mountains, cause we enforce the law. You can try to run, but you can never hide.
North South Connection Podcast Network, here we are again, and oh my god, I can't believe it. We are at episode 30 of the year that was, where we break down and rank every pay-per-view year in WWF history. My name's Aaron. I took 3 years. I watched every single pay-per-view, ranked them year by year, built this system of 12 categories that took a lot of tweaking. And here we are with the reveal, and my God, we're almost at the end, because we are tackling the seventh best year of all time. After this one, 6 more episodes, and holy shit, I got to get the next project going. I got to figure out my system for that. Seventh best year of all time, 1994. And look, before I get started, as usual, a sincere big thank you to everyone who has listened to this show at any point during its run. And on top of that, thank you for supporting everything that's been going on at the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Look, we started this project a little over a year ago, and look, we hope to stay consistent with our output, and I think for the most part we have, but I think honestly that's due in large part to having a really great, dedicated listener base that we've cultivated. And I mean, not just us, you guys have cultivated it too by being in touch with us and telling us what you like and what you don't like. So every comment, every download is a blessing, and I thank you for it. So, in 1994, I was in 8th grade. I had met the first love of my life at a park. A girl I knew since I was in kindergarten, but then I hung out with her one night and something just clicked. And it led to years of unrequited love. Yeah, I didn't even write that down in my notes. I was just thinking about that today. I don't know why. I don't know why she didn't. I don't know, maybe it's me. I'm clearly the problem. Anyway, I was in 8th grade in 1994, and wrestling wasn't very popular at my school. I know that in particular, in my friend circle, no one was really into wrestling but me. And to admit that you liked pro wrestling as a 14-year-old kind of made you the object of ridicule, which, you know, sucked, because it was, I loved it, you know? And being a fan of the product in this kind of atmosphere can feel super isolating. So not only was I watching these things alone, renting the tapes on the weekend, but I was scared of revealing my fandom to people due to its unpopularity. And this made it almost impossible to find someone else to enjoy the product. And I believe this still has an effect on me to this day. And I'm sure, I wonder if other people feel this way too. When you meet someone who's into wrestling, there's like this sense of relief. It's like, oh God, yes. Okay, we can talk about this thing that's important to both of our lives. And I'll be honest, I think the judgment of pro wrestling is really unfair to this little community we've cultivated. Because people don't bat an eyelash when you're obsessed with Big Brother, but wrestling, ugh, how can you watch that? Today, I still get, if someone hears, you know it's fake, right? Which is like the dumbest thing you can say. Of course I know it's fake. You're the one crying over who got killed on Game of Thrones, but I need to be reminded that this whole thing is fake? Art is art, right? And if it makes you feel anything, it's got some major, major value. And that's what wrestling was for me. And it's kind of a shame that it was isolating. But I think the internet really kind of helped us come together as a community. So in 1994, you know, based on that and other things, I was kind of on the precipice of leaving my fandom. Because I loved it, but it ceased to be a social activity. I still rented the tapes, but it was hard to follow, right? I followed the weekly product. But by the end of the year, I felt out of touch with it because no one in my circle was doing it, and it just wasn't a thing. And then that being said, these are all shows in 1994 that I went back to a billion times throughout my teenage years. And they held up just as well as they still do now, mainly because the year, for the most part, is built on wrestling. And when you keep things simple in this venue, it's actually quite a hard thing to mess up. 94 is a year that has some very strong ups and very few downs. And at worst, it's middling. And at its best, it's amazing. Let's hear from Jeffrey Thomas. My man, Jeffrey, many of us were keyed in during this time, although I had lost my virginity and had my first beer at this point. SummerSlam 94 was an all-timer for me personally because my friend and I were rooting for all different guys all night. I was all the Rule Breaker guys, and he was the fan favorites, with the exception of the main event. I'm curious, Jeffrey, if you called them Rule Breakers because of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. That's when I first heard the term Rule Breaker and fan favorite, I guess. I never heard Rule Breaker on WWF TV. They just called them. They didn't even call them anything. They just, if Jesse Ventura was cheering for them, they were a piece of shit, was basically the concept. Back to Jeffrey. I got all the pay-per-views that year and was treated to great shows each time out. And also loved the cowboy-themed Survivor Series. Yeah, that was fun. This year is nostalgic enough as an easy rewatch, but included with a neat annual package is the fantastic character work of Owen Hart. Yes. And the end of the Hulk Hogan bullshit we had to gag through for so many years. Awesome in itself. Then he continues, we know you enjoy the feedback, but I'm sure I speak with one voice that we really enjoy interacting with you as well. My spicy vanilla brother from another mother. Jeffrey, thank you, man. Yes, I love interacting with you guys too, and I hope I've made that clear, and it makes it worth it. So I really appreciate it, brother. All right, let's talk about some through lines. Through lines for 1994. Thank God for Bret Hart. But also, thank God for Owen Hart. And finally, with the through lines. So I think one thing I don't think the WWF gets enough credit for is growing up with his audience that they fostered in the 1980s. It's actually a lot like what J.K. Rowling did with the Harry Potter books. As her readers got older, she ended up infusing the books with darker themes and more complicated situations. It's really quite brilliant. And while I know I'm not publicly allowed to enjoy the Harry Potter books anymore, I just really think it's a really clear example. And I think the WWF does this really well too. In the 1980s, when my generation were kids, we got over-the-top superheroes. The Hogans, the Warriors, the Barbers. Okay, well, maybe they weren't all superheroes, but, you know, you get my drift. In the late 1990s, we got guys sticking it to authority, right? Which, I mean, we're 18, 19, 20, you know, 21, maybe 17, you know? But it's like, it's a sense of rebellion, and that's what you're going through during that period. We got the Austins and the Rocks. And so I think this middle period is really interesting. Because in the mid-90s, I think we got what every 14 or 15-year-old wants. I think we got a product that was cool. All the characters on the show were cool, from the way they dressed to the way they spoke and wrestled. And so if you look at the quartet of Bret, Diesel, Razor, and Shawn, man, those are like the coolest people in the world. They were so popular, they were so cool, that there were popular kids at my school to use them as nicknames, despite not even being fans of the product. And like, fuck them, right? Like, don't appropriate my fandom, assholes, when you're making fun of me for watching, right? Speaking of cool guys, please take a second to check out Viewer's Choice on the North South Connection Podcast Network. After every major wrestling event, Marcus and Tim, every single time they bring it, they're up late at night producing the show. And I'll be honest, I'm very grateful to them for breaking down WrestleMania Backlash for us, so I didn't have to watch the zombies. Again, not that I have a problem with zombies, but Jesus Christ, I'm tuning in for wrestling here, all right? And yes, I know there's people that are like, well, you put up with The Undertaker for all this time and he shoots lightning, but I hate that shit too. Don't make an argument like that I was defending The Undertaker in any way, shape, or form. I hate that bullshit. I just want wrestling. What I don't hate is Rank and File with Jordan Duncan. Once a month on the North-South Connection Podcast Network, it's a bracket-based tournament show. Not always bracket-based. Now they're kind of going one against the other. Their most recent endeavor was the greatest TV show series of all time, and they're working hard on that, getting it out there. And don't forget about Second Print Comics, which drops every Sunday with Mark Claire and Remzo Martinez. The last episode that I saw as of this recording was them breaking down their reading lists. Remso taking on the MCU. Never let it be said that this dude doesn't stick to his guns. So Second Print Comics, we're lucky to have it every Sunday on the North-South Connection podcast network. So first category breakdown this year in matches. I have it ranked 21st out of 36. So really one of the bad parts of the year. I have the average star rating at 2.833. But of the 36 matches that we have of the year, there's only 36 matches in the year. 11% of them hit 4 stars, which is the highest of any year for 4-star matches. And that being said, though, only 36% of the matches ended up being at least good. But what lands, lands hard. 50% of the matches are mediocre and only 14% outright bad. And of the 13 matches that qualify as good, only 2 are below 3.5 stars. So I think that's the reason why this gets a bit of a bump. So if you compare that to a year like 2016 that has about 1 billion 3-star matches, and they're just 3, right? Everything kind of becomes homogenized, right? Like, my God, I remember talking to JT about 2016 and like, it's a really strong year in-ring-wise, but I don't think before he went back and watched some of it, he remembered a ton of it. And with good reason. When I went back and watched it, I didn't remember a ton of it either, right? You have to really give yourself over to understand how good it is. It's an effort, right? But this year, 94 is entirely carried by Brett and the Click. Of the 13 best matches, only 3 don't either have Brett, Shawn, or Razor in them. So I get why they went on to become such a dominant force backstage. They were the whole show. I just don't see why Brett just didn't join the Click, right? Like, imagine all the problems that would have solved. Plus, they would have supported him cheating on that bitch, Julie. In fact, they would have encouraged it. I wish I could say there was some sort of like unifying marker on the back end of match quality, but there isn't, right? Because it's not like it's the same guy having all the same bad matches. Only 5 matches this year fall short of 2.5 stars, and there's no repeat offenders. One match involves a man named Dink teaming with another man named Doink. The next is 2 old men fighting at the Royal Rumble for no reason. Did we need Lawler and Piper in 1994? IRS is obviously one of the worst in one of the worst of the matches. Like, imagine a match where a guy dressed like a giant grape is the most exciting part of the match. And yes, the fans were asked to throw their hands in the air. But what they didn't know is that what were they agreeing to? When Mabel comes down and you're throwing your hands in the air, what are you agreeing to? What you're agreeing to is another 15 years of Mabel. Sit on those fucking hands. I'd rather just take them off. You can take one of my hands if it means I don't have to be raped like Matt Hardy. Look, Mabel comes down on that dude's ass with the force of 1,000 violins. That man did not deserve that. Leading us, of course, to our worst match of the year, which I would have loved to give to Lex and Yoko, because the problem with that one is I know they can have a good match. But alas, one person has to keep his 0-star match streak going. Only one man fought himself on pay-per-view. Did you guys, when you were watching this, and if you've ever seen this guy before, have you guys noticed that Brian Lee kind of looks like The Undertaker? Obviously, the worst match of 1994. The Undertaker versus The Undertaker from the SummerSlam. 0 stars. And I'll be honest, I'm sorry, I'm not watching it. Look, I love you guys. I hope you appreciate how much I care about everybody who listens, and I love doing the show. And I feel like give a lot to the show. You know, it's a job to put together. I've given a lot. You know, I've given my sanity some of the best years of my life. But I'm sorry, I can't watch this match again. I just can't. I can't watch the giant urn fleshlight that Paul Bearer sprays all over the audience. I can't do it. And I don't need that. I don't need Teddy Biasi ruining. I don't need one in purple and one in gray. I don't need any of it. The match is slow. It's dumb. It's devoid of any heat. It's so quiet that Vince is like, "Oh, the audience has had a hush has come over the audience because they're so enthralled in what they've seen, the wrestling that is happening on the WWF television." I can't do it. I won't. I really hope you forgive me. But clearly it's the worst match of the year. You all know it. Let's talk about the five best. I'll talk more about those, all right? Honorable mentions. Number four, breaking four stars. Now, I know this match is short, but I wanted to give it some love and an honorable mention. Owen Hart versus the 1-2-3 Kid from the King of the Ring tournament. Let's go to the top five, because only one match that cracked four stars for me is out of the top five. So the fifth best match of the year, Brett the Hitman Hart versus Bob Backlund. Submission match from the Survivor Series. And I'll be honest, until I watched this match for this project, I thought the match was boring until this great rewatch project. And it really, it's just really different. And that's what makes it great. Because it feels like an amateur style match for the most part. And Brett and Backlund are the exact right guys to have in that kind of match. Even the chicken wing, which I thought was applied for like 45 minutes, was like really just 5-6. And I think it worked really well in the drama. And man, I love watching Backlund. He's so good when he gets the belt. He's looking at his hands. He's doing that weird duck walk all over the ring. Like, it's the whole presentation of it is just really great. Number four, Bret Hart versus Owen Hart. Cage match, SummerSlam. So I fucked up and included this in my SummerSlam section. So I guess we'll just deal with it then. Number three at four stars. The Royal Rumble match. And again, I do a whole section on that match, so we'll talk about it in a minute. Let's deal with the two best matches of the year. You know what they are. Just what's the order, right? Number two. Razor Ramon versus Shawn Michaels, WrestleMania 10 ladder match. I have this at five stars. And look, I can't really add too much more to the litany of compliments this match has received over the years. What I will say is that one of the things I love the most about the match is how well they use the ladder as a weapon in the match. It felt brutal and rough. It wasn't guys trying to figure out ways how to flip and fly off a ladder, which can be all interesting too, but that's not what this match was. This match was two guys trying to hurt one another with a ladder, and it has a couple of very good high spots worked in. It's a revolutionary match that completely delivers, even to this day, I think. And the image of Ramon at top of the ladder with the two titles is completely iconic. And so, only one match this year could be number one if the ladder match is number two. It's from the same show, WrestleMania 10. Bret Hart versus Owen Hart. And again, there's been so much written about this already. I won't go on and on about it. But obviously the match, it's the match that legitimizes Owen Hart as a force in the promotion. And Brett begins the match wrestling like he doesn't want to be out there, which plays perfectly into the story. And it's a great contrast to Owen, who is completely out for blood and trying to beat his brother and teach him a lesson and show him. So it isn't just an athletic contest. It is an athletic contest, but it isn't just that. These two are telling a great family story. And even to the point where midway through the match, Brett kind of stops midway when he's done something to Owen. He stopped midway and he puts his arms in the air. He's like, this is what you wanted, right? This is what you wanted. And Owen is pissed. If there was any flaw in the match, I would say that it's Lawler and McMahon on commentary. And I think they're fine. I don't want to say they're bad, right? I think they're a good pairing. But for me, not the best at getting the story across. I think Gorilla and Jesse would have killed it, right? But I think the problem is not Vince. I think it's Lawler because he's got the feud with Brett. So it becomes about that instead, which is kind of annoying. That's just how I feel about it. Again, it's not a bad thing. It's just, if there was one bad thing, it was that. The ending of the match, though, is great with Owen reversing the victory roll. And I love after he gets the three, I love this part that he goes and confirms the three count with the ref. And then he goes and flashes the three fingers in Brett's face. And then he walks out victoriously. It's beautiful. It really is beautiful. Beautiful like the soothing voices of Justin Pratt and Tim Slomka, who drop every other Wednesday on North South. Recently, they hit their 10th episode. Now, this is usually the sticking point for me. When I'm like, oh, I hit 10? I guess I'm actually going to follow this through, right? But on the latest episode, I heard they talk about Hulk Hogan breaking in. Because they're covering, it's New Gen on a Mission. And they are covering the New Generation era from the Survivor Series 1992 to Survivor Series 1997. Brett and Shawn to Brett and Shawn. And they're covering Hogan's return in early 93, which was not the most welcome sight as he looked like a completely tanned walrus. Anyway, Justin and Tim always bring it. I love the show. Check it out if you got the time. Let's hear from Ryan Gray, my man Ryan Gray. Ryan Gray, Aaron. Fuck, why? Why would you do that? Why? When I was in grade 3 in French, I had a French teacher, and because all my teachers were in French, so I went to French school. I had a teacher call me for a whole, I was like 9, right? For the whole year, she called me Aaron. Aaron. And I corrected her, and she said, no, Aaron. It drove me fucking crazy. And she was so scary. She's a crazy little old woman. Her name was Therese Aaron. Oh, gosh, she was scary. I bite my nails to this day because of this woman. And also, so not only that, but then now in schools, because I do shows in schools, if I tell the kids my name, I get, hey, Aaron. So thanks, Ryan, for bringing that up, making me feel like that. Back to Ryan. Aaron. Oh, I can't believe that 1994 scored so well. Banner year for the Hitman. You take him out. What's left? Brutal tag division. And then he asks, did one good women's match at SummerSlam propel it past the medium score given to the non-existent years? We'll get to it. We'll get to it. Yes, it did. Because I don't think it's just about one good match. I think it's about trying to make it feel important. But we'll get there. Mid-card stuff feels like it'll do well here. We'll see. However, the main event feels like the mid-card. Yeah. But it was who they had. Right? So I think it's different with Brett on top. Brett's on top with Shawn and Razor on the undercard. That's fine. Right? It's a lot different when you're doing that than if it's Brett on top with the Ultimate Warrior and Macho Man in the undercard. Right? So I think for me, that didn't bother me so much. Back to Ryan. Bret Hart and Nostalgia carried 1994 into the top 10. Banner year for Owen. Brett did a good job of putting him on the map. Yep. Shawn Michaels could have helped the mid-card here. Great Rumble performance to go off the epic ladder match. Then he was a manager for the rest of the year. Love the pod, Aaron. More than 1994, apparently. But then he jumps back in because he forgot something. I didn't even mention The Undertaker. He had 2 casket matches. The first one where his spirit left him. If only the 8 wrestlers who helped Yoko were dressed as zombies. And we'd probably, well, some people would defend it.
No, we had worse. You know, we had a lot worse.
Look, last thing on the zombies. Last thing. So if zombies come up on a pay-per-view, right? And you say, well, like, you know, zombies aren't bad because we've had so many other things that are so much worse. Like, maybe you have Stockholm Syndrome. Like, if there's so many bad things that zombies are like, well, you know, zombies. You know, anyway, no more zombies. Back to Ryan. Then he talks about the doppelganger match at SummerSlam. This is the main event scene. Yeah, I guess I didn't really count it as the main event scene. Like, to me, The Undertaker for these years, even though he challenged for the title at the Rumble, The Undertaker felt like this entirely separate thing. Like, it's like there was this show going on, and then it reminded me of, like, the Super Mario Brothers Super Show. From the 90s. It's like 4 days a week you get Mario and Luigi, and then that one day you get Legend of Zelda cartoon. Hey everybody, I'm Link! Ah! Like that guy. That's kind of how I feel about The Undertaker throughout his early run. It's like, oh, there's this other thing that's happening. All right. Well, Ryan, I'll try to make some sense of it for you. To be honest, this is not something that would spring to my mind in top 10. So I hear what you're saying. All right, characters. 10th out of 36. I'd pay money to know who made the pitch for the Double J character to Vince McMahon. So not only, dude, Vince, not only is this guy trying to use the WWF to make it in country music, but get this, you ready? He fucking spells his name. And then in between some of the letters, he says, ha ha! This drives me crazy. I can deal with the spelling of the name. It's annoying. It's a good heel thing. But the fourth, J-E-double-F, ha ha, J-A-double-R-E-double-T, like that laugh, ha ha. The forced laughter drives me absolutely insane, right? And to be honest, like if this is something that, if forced laughter upsets you as a person, then Vince McMahon on commentary makes you want to eat your own dick, right? And on top of that, Jeff Jarrett is going, I feel like I'm watching TNA and trying to make sense of the storylines. Jeff Jarrett is using the World Wrestling Federation. This guy's fucking stupid. Who has ever springboarded from wrestling into something else at this point and been taken seriously? Use country music to get into wrestling. Fine. Not the other way around. Hulk Hogan and Roddy Piper were two of the biggest stars of all time. And all they could manage in Hollywood was chewing bubblegum and a goddamn Old Spice commercial. What country music executive is looking for talent and scouring the ranks of professional wrestling to find the next big country music star? They can't be that short on talent. I've been led to believe that if you live south of the Mason-Dixon line, you're gifted with a guitar and a case of sorrow at birth. And even if the executive watched the show, he's going to hire the guy wearing 36 suspenders? What is that look? In an era where everyone is looking cool, how did Double J think this was the way to go? And don't even get me started on that headband. Adam Bomb was going to win the Royal Rumble, and then clearly disappointed father figure Vince McMahon. So what was Adam Bomb's deal? Was he suffering from radiation poisoning? Is that what was wrong with his eyes? Was he dying? Am I watching a dying man? And did he rehabilitate himself with cannabis? So, at the time, though, was he part of a nuclear holocaust, or was he the living bomb? Now, I ask this because in the past, we've had living boats and typhoons. Why not a living bomb? I did dig his costume, though. And I have no clue how he wasn't bigger than he was with that look. Tatanka, I believe, was... I guess he was like the last in a long line of Native American wrestlers. He was fine, but I can't get past the fact that they didn't change his gimmick at all when he turned heel. It just looked dirtier. Like it's almost like they just kind of like put some a tad of brown dye in his stuff, and that was it, right? I also will never understand why by 94 they're sticking so heavily with the Lex Luger USA gimmick. Like It's fine. You want to have him do that in 93 with Yoko as champ? Go for it. But now, why? Why can't we just have badass Lex Luger? Why does he have to wear the flag on his penis? Those tights are so tight that if Martha Washington walked by him, those tights would explode and usher in the Attitude Era. Doink is a happy clown is already trash. Doink with pinks and winks and dinks. What are we doing here? Pure insanity. Is Sione less of a barbarian now? Did Fatu and Afa civilize him? Also, how did they pull him away from hunting? Because his collection of antlers was spectacular. I don't see how or why he would leave that. And where the fuck is Samu? Glammed up Davy Boy Smith is something else. I don't understand what the look is. Jacked up dude, tucked in shirt, wild hair, glasses. I guess we should be grateful he's not wearing jeans. He's pulling up. It's also the swan song of Randy Savage, and what better way to leave than with a personal feud? So, for Randy Savage, a feud, since they're all personal. He tried to be a good friend, but Crush is apparently a douchebag. Who would have thought? Who would have thought Crush was a douchebag? Speaking of Crush, why did he keep calling himself Crush after the turning heel? He wasn't crushing people anymore. He was just, you know, a weird guy now. And I get, like... You know, you're the fluorescent-wearing, mullet-sporting, like, happy-go-lucky crush guy, like, to crush, you know, that guy, that's fine. But now, he's purple, and he's purple not men in a mission crush. He's the only other purple guy in the promotion. He's painting his face now, and it feels like Fuji maybe has taught him some martial arts. He also seems more miserable, you know? And he's more miserable here than when he went to prison. Maybe when he comes back from prison, he's just happy to be out. Why he's so miserable here? Like, he's joining a black supremacist group. He's still more miserable here. Is it during this year that he got high off Adam Bomb's crippling cancer and decided to form a tag team with the man? Bam Bam Bigelow's banging Luna. I'm unsure if the vampire she would later marry is happy about this or not. I mean, sadly, they're all dead. They're fucking all dead. I mean, Gangrel's not dead, but, you know, he doesn't appear to be. If you've seen him, he doesn't look like he's alive. IRS is doing the same shit he's been doing for the past 3 years. Never once was it entertaining. Alundra Blaze, happy babyface champion. Hooray. Mabel, the physical manifestation of a thyroid problem. And Mo. Mo is the worst. All right? I don't like to... I'm a language guy, right? I don't like to throw around the word pear a lot. But damn it, that's the only way to describe his body and his physical appearance. And the hair is wrong. It's all wrong. It's... His hair... Is it dyed or is he old? I don't know. I don't want to know. I just want it to stop. Please stop. Why did Vince have to be in that elevator with Oscar rapping? And why did he have to like it? Now, the Quebecers are another story altogether. And if only from the perspective that I live in Quebec, and I know tons of people that behave exactly in that way. They would be what Quebecers call in French, un astide baveu. A baveu. And baveur means fuck, loudmouth in like in a mean way, right? But the whole act is like a giant fuck you to everyone. The Mounties want to sue the company? Well, guess what? We're not the Mounties. We're dressed like the Mounties. Now there's two of us. And there's no way the Mounties would tolerate the fucking weird beatnik hippie yuppie Johnny Polo jumping around in the air. No, sir. They would run his ass down immediately on that horse. And their song. Oh, we're not the Mounties. The best, maybe the best theme song of all time. Jim Neidhart is a living, breathing body of meat. All right, Shawn Michaels as the guy hiding behind the bodyguard is great. It's a great role for him. I love that he went out and had that ladder match and then said, "Nah, you know what? I'm going to retire for the rest of the year. I'm good." Diesel was becoming quite the ass kicker until they made him too cool for school. Like when his promos backstage when he's champion. Yeah, you know, here we are, right? I'm the champ, and the champ's gotta take care of business, if you know what I mean. And I do my business in the ring, or maybe with some lady. Like, fuck, no! Razor Ramon was the coolest motherfucker on the planet. I once told my friend at the bus stop when I was 13, just like a bit before this, that I wanted to grow my beard out like Razor Ramon to impress girls. He wasn't convinced. And it took me years to get laid. So, Adam Grayton, if you're listening, you were correct, sir. Also, I could never grow facial hair. I have lots of problems. Bret Hart, as the honorable champion, was great. Doesn't want to fight his brother. Offers a legend a shot at the title. Hell, he's even a real good sportsman with the 1-2-3 kid. He was tough and believable, which was exactly what the promotion needed in the wake of Hulkamania overdosing. Owen Hart was fantastic as the sniveling little brother. He just... hated Greasy Brett. And with good reason. Why couldn't he just fucking tag him? Brett deserved to have his leg kicked out from under his leg. This, of course, culminated... The whole year culminates with Owen manipulating his parents into fucking Brett out of the title at the Survivor Series. He goes from crocodile tears to hysterical laughter in a second, which is beautiful. Bob Backlund goes insane, right? And I'm there for it, man. I loved this character at the time. I loved him looking at his hands. I loved the strange duck waddle around the ring. Every little thing he does, every little thing Bob did was magic. I loved it all. All of it. Finally, The Undertaker. Yeah, you're right, Ryan. Undertaker's bad. Dies at WrestleMania, dies at the Royal Rumble. Ascends to the heavens. Does a speech first, though, which, you know, I guess we should be thankful for. He cared enough about the fans to let us know where his spirit was going to go. And then he disappeared into some sort of laser show. It looked like something you'd see at a waterfall. Then he comes back when Leslie Nielsen and company start seeing Undertaker sightings around. He has to deal with an imposter, and finally he gets revenge by employing Chuck Norris to watch his back. Strange. It's a strange year. Strange like TNA. Jenny, JT, and I started all the way back in July of 2002, and we've watched every single episode of NWA TNA. We're in the year 2003 now, these weekly pay-per-views. On TNA Never Dies. It's been great, but also torturous. Fun, but suicide-inducing. And now Vince Russo's running roughshod over the promotion, and I'm being pushed to the brink. I'm being pushed to the brink so much that I'm starting to like Jeff Jarrett. TNA Never Dies drops every other Tuesday on North South, and that runs in tandem with Jacob Williams' Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast. In a recent episode, he was joined by Ben Locke, and they break down Triple H being gifted the Raw title in what can I really, I guess I can only really describe it as, I guess the bullet that put the WWE in a permanent coma. Anyway, Ruthlessly Aggressive with Jake is a fun show every other Tuesday. TNA Never Dies is insanity. Join us for it. Check it out. All right, let's hear from Steven Van Kooten. By 1994, I was out of the wrestling bubble, but I managed to catch a few select moments in real time. I remember gaining a huge amount of respect for Brett, who was obviously the best thing on the show. His feud with Owen and the pathos and energy that rivals the best feuds in the promotion have ever told. I agree. Brett may be the greatest babyface ever for refusing to go to blows with his brother, despite the constant taunting and betrayals. It's a true roller coaster ride. The rest of the roster isn't so great, but Backlund is a joy to watch. As he becomes the poster child for mental illness, the war on drugs, pseudo-intellectualism, and attempting to murder people. Basically, he's a politician. Am I right? Looking at most of the characters, you can see why the Fed struggled. Everything outside of Brett was horribly juvenile. Even as a kid, when I saw Diesel and Shawn Michaels, I knew which one would be the top. Make that what you will. The Undertaker becomes the plot of Naked Gun 4 and Lone Wolf McQuade 2 in the same year. Jeff Jarrett looks like Dolly Parton and Fabio met in a little whorehouse in Texas. Lex Luger vies for Sting's title as dumbest babyface in history, while Tatanka commits the most ineffectual heel turn in the history of mankind with a roll-up. Well, hey, he did kick him after the match. Back to Steven. The year was almost as good as Bull Nakano's dump truck rear. It's truly missed. Bull's ass, I mean. Not 1994. It was good, though. Hey, Steven. All right. WrestleMania. 7 out of 36. So, I've heard, this is a weird one because I've always kind of viewed it as like, I even said this myself, like it's a two-match show, right? But how many matches have to be all-timers where we stop saying that? There's 9 matches and 2 of them are in, they're at least in my top 20 matches of all time. That's a pretty fucking good show. Like how, and in the rest, it's not like anything else is really bad. Except for the, well, we'll get there. But, you know, I've said it myself. It's a two-match show, but it's fine. Most shows don't have 2 matches this good. So Mania opens with the aforementioned Hart versus Hart match, which still ranks as either the greatest opener or at worst the second greatest opener in the history of WrestleMania. I think I like the Triple H Bryan one better, but I have them neck and neck in my rankings. Then Bam Bam and Luna fight 2 clowns. In retrospect, we always shit on Face Doink. But damn, he got a pretty great reaction every time he came out. Maybe the people really love Dink. Anyway, Bam Bam beats the living shit out of him, which I think is totally the right move. And there's no way Doink could take Bam Bam in any situation. In fact, if they were in prison together, Bam Bam would fucking own that green ass. I can't even begin to think about what they would do to Doink or Dink. And it would not be fun. Then the illustrious career at WrestleMania of Randy Savage ends in a Falls Count Anywhere match with Crush. This match has the strangest rules in any Falls Count Anywhere match. When a guy loses a fall, he's got 60 seconds to make it back into the ring. So this leads to Savage getting pinned within 60 seconds as Crush drops him on the barricade, but then he gets back up and gets back in. But 60 seconds is a long time. Can you imagine how unbeatable John Cena would be in this stipulation? It's physically impossible. The dude, Cena, this guy goes from being knocked out, right, to running a marathon on your cousin within 4 seconds. Anyway, the other problem with this is that, I mean, falls don't really count anywhere when a fall in the ring is pointless. If you pin someone in the ring, it doesn't count. It's useless. Then that's not anywhere. Savage has to hit an elbow drop in the ring, roll him to the outside, and pin him. It's such a strange way to do this match. You know, when you shit on TNA for doing, like, reverse battle royals, like, you gotta take a hard look at this one. And it makes no sense. Then they fight all around the building. Savage struggles to tie Crush into a scaffolding. He just can't get those legs to stay in the air. And I think it's probably because those legs are so fucking pumped full of HGH that they'd be legally considered bovine. Crush's legs keep falling. I guess he's held down by the weight of some moderately thin rope. But whatever, Savage wins. He gets back to the ring, rides off into the sunset as a winner. I'm guessing it was at the victory party for this match that he was seduced by Stephanie. She probably scolded him for being a petulant child. And he was like, I'll show you, petulant, yeah. Anyway, the rest is history. Alundra Blaze fights Leilani Kai in a perfectly fine match. I guess they found Kai at the graveyard where they were burying the Undertaker. I mean, there's no other explanation why she could where she could have been for the last 6 years. I guess I can only assume that she was revived for this match. Or she was living with Donna Martin in like a golden glamour girl situation. And yes, Jimmy Hart is Sophia in this wonderful world. Then Men on a Mission come rapping to the ring. And again, I'm going to, you know, this is not a team. This is a team I shit on time to time, right? But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention how over these grapes were. You know, they fought the Quebecers, who were one of my favorite acts of all time. The match is fine, but my enduring memory is, and I love this. I could watch, I've rewound this moment to watch it. So Pierre is trying to suplex Mabel, and he starts screaming at Jacques to help him. And he's like, tabarnak, viens donc, calis, on va lever ta merde. Like, it's so real. Like, I've seen French people in my area scream at each other in the exact same way. And look, I've even partaken, right? I once drove past some guys that were, they were working on a roof. Like, they were standing on a roof. I guess they were tarring it or something. And I pulled up in my car on the street and I yelled, hey, descend le tabarnak! Which basically means, hey, get the fuck down from there! And I obviously didn't know these people. They were more shocked that there was a man screaming at, I guess I wasn't a man in this moment, but they were more shocked that someone was screaming at them from a car than anything else. Anyway, back to Men on a Mission. They win via a countout, I think once they won, I think Vince Gate like ran an audible and got Oscar to rap again because he was not ready. Like the music starts, he's like, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. And then from that point on, it was all throwing your hands in the air and in the atmosphere. And then they're just shouting, yeah, and whoop, there it is. And the Men on a Mission are a pretty good time capsule of the entire 1990s. Then Lex Luger and Yoko stuck up the joint. It's 14 minutes of sheer boredom. I guess they both knew they weren't getting the belt, so they said, fuck it, I'm not trying. And the most memorable thing in this match was Mr. Perfect's referee suit. I don't know why he felt the need to wear striped pants. I've never seen any referee in any situation wear striped fucking pants. And look, I'm no fashionista or anything, but it's a statistical impossibility that those stripes from the pants are going to line up from the stripes of the shirt. And then it's this, you can't look at it. It's a jumbled mess of a person. And he's all weird. It's hard to focus on him. It's like watching squaggly porn and then realizing it's not what you thought you were watching. And then he gets angry because someone shoves him, and it's the laziest, most boring finish they could have possibly done. And what do they do with the guy who was clearly cheated by a referee for the championship? What do they do with him for the rest of the year? Well, they put him in a feud with the worst manager of all time. I don't know. I have no clue how Lex Luger gets blamed for his WWF run. He comes in with a hot gimmick, the narcissist, which they immediately take away from him, drape him in the flag. Then they don't even give him a win because they want to keep the title on the sumo wrestler. Next, they choose Bret Hart over him. Well, the fans do. But how could they not after the year that Luger had? It makes no sense. Bret had been in the company for a decade and was consistently popular. Not only that, but he'd been cheated out of the belt the year before and never really got another shot. While Luger was riding in buses, Bret was winning tournaments and in a super hot feud with Jerry Lawler. Meanwhile, poor Lex has been in the company of a year, has had no time to establish himself as either a heel or a face because they keep switching him. They give him empty victories. They label him as a choker. They bring in ringers to get him out of the Royal Rumble who can't even be bothered to focus on him. Luger's awesome, all right? And for all the talk of WCW, this has been a thing for a long time. WCW wouldn't know what to do with a Bret Hart. Well, guess what? WWF had no fucking clue what to do with Lex Luger, with a Lex Luger. Dan Earthquake has to go over Adam Bomb for some reason. Call me crazy, you know, but I just feel in 1994, maybe the right move was pushing the young guy who looks like $1 million more over the guy who was at his hottest 4 years earlier. Ladder match is next. Obviously, it's great. And then Bret wins the belt from Yoko in a match that pales from the year before, but the moment is really perfect. The faces flood the ring. They treat him like the rightful conquering hero, put him on the shoulders, and all the while, Owen, who beat him earlier, is lurking at the aisle. It's a perfect ending to an incredible show. And I normally talk about adjustments I'd make to make the show better, but you know, whatever. Like, the adjustment would be like, can Luger and Yoko just have a match equal to what they did at SummerSlam 93? Maybe you could put Adam Bomb over, but fuck, that was 60 seconds. Who cares? The show's awesome. I'm too dumb to be able to fix it. World title storyline, 14th out of 36. So, I think we need to remember, and this is for Ryan, I guess, that it's world title storyline, not main event storyline. So the year starts with Yokozuna needing 57 guys to murder and defeat The Undertaker. I mean, like, if this is the height of your title reign, you're really not a credible champion anymore. Then Yoko goes into Mania, where he has to defend twice. Even if the Luger match is trite, the concept is cool. So I think the concept is interesting and gave the title a real air of importance, which is good. Like, there's been so many years where the title isn't treated as important. Then Brett gets the belt, has a solid defense against Diesel, great one with Owen and Backlund. And both feuds are super hot. Owen had established himself as someone who could beat the champion, so it's booking 101 to give him a pay-per-view title match. And Backlund was also organically built through an exhibition match that led to an old guy snapping. And even though the Survivor Series with Brett was Brett and Backlund, it still felt like the reminiscence of the Owen feud as he was the second, right? This is a sign of a healthy division where everything is leading organically one match to the next. Owen beats Brett at Mania. Owen wins King of the Ring. Then Owen challenges and loses. So he comes back to fuck over his brother. This is the world title scene, right? When you connect things like this, it really gives the impression that everything matters. And for me, that's super important. Christ, a throwaway match on Superstars led to not only a huge character change, but the crowning of a world champion. And I'll say even Diesel taking the belt is cool, right? It's hard to look at 94 and judge his title reign, especially since we know how it's not the best. But it all made sense storyline-wise. Sometimes a champion loses to a random dude. That's what happened to Mike Tyson, right? Now, revisionist history might tell us that Diesel was not the right guy. But when Diesel wins the title, his victory opens up three credible challengers, that are all organically connected throughout the year 1994. Right? It's not like they have to have a number one contenders match or just any bullshit or another rematch. I mean, they could do it if they want. So, like, I mean, you got three contenders. You got Backlund. I mean, it's a rematch, but he can make a claim based on the fact that he was jumped and he wasn't ready. Brett has a claim because he was cheated out of the belt by his brother. And then you got Shawn Michaels, who's got the personal issue with Diesel. I mean, you could even throw in Razor into that argument because he beat Diesel. It's organic. Like, it feels like we're moving forward. You don't need anything convoluted to get to the matches because everything's so well set up. That's why it's 14th, because it's all really well tied together. It's a really healthy scene. Mid-card storyline, Ryan, you were right. It did well, 5th out of 36. And I don't think Razor Ramon gets the credit he deserves as one of the greatest Intercontinental Champions of all time. He is the foundation of a very strong mid-card. I won't go as far to say as he was presented on par with the world champions, but in kayfabe terms, I think you could see him being able to take on Brett, Yoko, Backlund, Diesel, and he'd be entirely credible. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of the Ultimate Warrior Intercontinental reign, in which he's like presented like completely important and completely credible on his own. Contrast with, say, like, Bret Hart's I don't want to shit on Bret's Intercontinental reign in 1991. It's not to shit on him, right? But, like, when you see Bret as Intercontinental champion in 1991, for me, it's hard to see him on the same level as Hogan and The Undertaker at the time. And even when he first won it in 92, it was from Ric Flair, right? For it to even be remotely believable. But even then, with Savage and Warrior on top, something looked weird, right? So look at Ramon here. Ramon, you know, you could slide him up to the main event. It wouldn't look bizarre at all. But he's a great anchor, and because he's a great anchor, it's always going to do well. You could be angry that Ramon has a pay-per-view match against IRS, and I am, but he also produced the ladder match, which is considered one of the greatest matches of all time. And even if you don't love that match, it's really hard to minimize its influence. The tag guys would come in 2000 and make the ladder match something completely different, but now it's nothing short of revolutionary. And as much as Brett can say he invented the match, sorry, it's always going to be Razor's and Shawn's. That's just how it is, and it's because they went out and delivered. Later in the year, Diesel wins the Intercontinental title, and it's midway through the year about. And I think this is a really important stepping stone for him. His rematch with Ramon, on top of being very strong, is the celebrity match at SummerSlam. So they don't bring in Walter Payton for the world title or the fucking Undertaker fiasco. No, no, they bring him in for this. That's how important it is. You could also throw Savage and Crush into an undercard feud. A personal contest. You know, it's well done. I mean, the less said about Mabel and Jeff Jarrett, which was centered on rap versus country, the better. But then, how can we ignore the influence of this feud between Jeff Jarrett and Mabel? It might be one of the few times WCW took an idea from WWF and did it better. As a rule, stolen ideas are almost never as good as the original, regardless of what promotion. So, like, the NWO sucked in the WWF. Buzzkill was a shitty version of shitty Brian James. But the West Texas Rednecks took the baton from a young Jeff Jarrett and produced musical gold. In a perfect world, Mabel would have joined the No Limit Soldiers, but unfortunately they had a very strict no diabetes policy. Let me hear from a man, Rocco Martone. Rocco writes in, I graduated high school in June of 1994, and hearing Macho Man, this is so true, and hearing Macho Man's music in a big-ass football stadium was certainly the best part of that day. You know, it's funny. I wonder how many people viewed that pomp and circumstance. You hear it at a graduation, and it's like, oh, you know. Like, because I'm sure there's people that know it as the graduation song, but I feel there's a whole thwart of people that are like, no, that's Macho Man's song. back to Rocco. I was out of the WWF at the time, but hearing Pomp and Circumstance reminded me of a simpler time of dropping elbows off couches and slapping a figure four on my buddy's younger brother. Yep, you would get along with my buddy Reg, who would put his brother in a sharpshooter until he passed out. Rewatching on this on 24/7 years later, I did not fall in love with this year, but I did always love my man Bam Bam. So how do you think your being Canadian affects your judgment of this year since it's so heart-heavy? I am personally biased towards Bigelow LT as the best celebrity match of all time because I was all in on both those Jersey heroes. Okay, so I'm not a big Brett guy. Even though I'm Canadian. In fact, the only time I really loved Brett was in 97 when they were actually doing the whole Canadian feud. So I don't, and I went through this time when I didn't like Bret Hart at all, right? I like him more now. And you know, when you go back and watch all these pay-per-views, I think it's impossible not to like Bret Hart more because you're seeing a lot of guys wrestle over and over, and then you're seeing Bret be really credible all the time. So I don't know how much it affected. But I will say that there is a large group of the population that has Bret Hart as their favorite wrestler of all time, right? And I think it's got to come from this year because I think it's his best year. So I'd like to think I'm not biased on it. But especially since a lot of the positives from this year come from the mid-card, right? Which he is not part of. But we'll see. Maybe. All right. Back to Rocco. I also listened to Vince this year, and it really sounds like the dude's having fun. Vince is certainly the most fascinating person I think wrestling has ever encountered. It actually bums me out to think that he has pushed his love aside in favor of making money. Aaron, what is your theory on Vince and his love for wrestling? So my working theory with Vince and his love for wrestling is that he loved wrestling until it was shit on by mainstream. I think it was shit on by mainstream. So I think he wanted to use the World Wrestling Federation to make a bigger impact somewhere else. I think. And I think because it was rejected by the mainstream, he in turn rejected his own product. And I think it's really sad, right? I don't think it's that he loves making money as opposed to wrestling. I think it's because he would never achieve who he wanted to be through wrestling, regardless of success, right? Because, I mean, look, the guy's a billionaire through wrestling, right? But he's not a Hollywood guy. He's not accepted as part of mainstream culture. And I think that probably burns at him. I think that's why you've seen all the football leagues or bodybuilding, I guess, the football leagues, the movie studios, you know, the cartoons on the network. I think he views himself as a P.T. Barnum, like a jack of all trades. But he's good at one thing, and he hates that he's only good at this one thing. And I think he'd be fine with being good at this one thing if everybody loved this one thing, but they don't. And not only that, they look down on it. And I think it's made him extremely adversarial. So to give you a context, well, here, I'll read the rest of your comment first. What is your relationship with your love of theater and the relationship with your love has had with commerce? Have you ever regretted monetizing your passion? I know if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life, but is that true? Yes, I think that's true. I think you can fall out of love with what you do too, though. So like, you know, for years, I was talking about this on a recent episode I did with Jenny Smith and Tim Capel on Talk and Pop, where for years I struggled for respect in a theater community. But I was doing children's theater, you know, not children, but teens, you know, and the theater community will never respect anything like that. And it ate me up forever. But then I started making money and it ceased to matter what they think. And it made me focus harder on this. I think I kind of took the opposite tact of Vince. I didn't resent that they didn't respect what I did. Instead, I was like, well, I'm making money doing what I do, so someone respects it. It doesn't have to be the person I want to respect it. And I kind of wish Vince would take more of that tact. Like, your product is good enough and amazing enough that you're a billionaire a couple times over now. That is a success. That is an incredible success. So I never regret monetizing my art, not for one second, because it allows me to feed my family and do something that keeps me sane. Rocco, you're the man. All right, tag team storyline, 21 out of 36. So again, this is the low point. But again, let's notice the low point is 21, right? I wish it was better, as I would have children with either of the Quebecers. Yes, I would insist that they be the ones that birthed them out of their penis, but it doesn't mean I don't love them. 1994 represents main eventers jumping back into the tag scene too, which I think, as strange as it is, lends it importance. So it's like the year starts with Brett and Owen going for the tag titles against the Quebecers, and that selfish piece of shit, Brett, just won't tag. Then the head shrinkers at King of the Ring defend against Yoko and Crush. Yoko was just the champion. Michaels and Diesel team up to beat the head shrinkers later. Like, so it's a division that's obviously good enough that main eventers are coming in and out of it. But here's the weird thing with this year. For some reason, they refuse to show a tag team title change on pay-per-view. There's six title changes, and one happens on Raw. All the others happen on a house show. Like, which is strange. Every other month, Sean Mooney or Doc Hendricks, who were the Asian guy they used for 6 weeks, they come on and like, we have some news from the house show. I don't know why I'm doing it. Michael Schumacher has some news from the house show. I guess they're trying to stress the importance of the house shows. But still, like, it ended up giving us pretty sanitized matches on the shows where everybody's paying for them. Women's storyline. Okay, so I had it 10th. Maybe high. But I really love that they were trying, right? They were trying to make a legitimate division. So it's like, I think the women's wrestling today is extremely legitimate. And I've gone on at length about how I think from 2015 on, you're looking at a completely different product, right? And I love that product. I think this is the closest they ever came to it before, was 94, 95. So I think that holds a lot of weight for me. It's not like Alundra Blaze was lighting the world on fire. Her matches were fine, but the company seemed to be taking steps to take the division seriously. Blaze was a fine champion. She's someone who looked and acted like a credible women's wrestler. Her return match with Leilani Kai was strong, but her match with Bull Nakano was legitimately very good. I think there was some really great potential here. For whatever reason, they couldn't follow up. People liked Blaze, and they were ready to buy in. Look, if they had kept bringing in Nakano level talent, I think they would have had a legit, really strong division. Look, I guess it was more important to have Hot Rod fight Jerry Lawler or have 1,000 doinks in there. Yeah, that feels better than having a legitimately great women's division. Why don't you give them that time? Man, I might have thrown the belt in the trash too. All right, Royal Rumble match. The line that always sticks with me for this match is Ted DiBiase going, "Look at what they're doing to Bret Hart." Everybody's just kicking the shit out of him. I think this is a really underrated iteration of the Rumble. It's forgotten. It's consistently entertaining from start to finish. At the very beginning, but you know, early enough. And I think it's an exquisite example of how to use the match to get a bunch of guys over. This one's famous for the tie with Bret and Lex, but my God, if Bret was in control of that fall, he did the most amazing job possible. You can shit on this result too all you want, but understand that it's infinitely better than if Hulk Hogan had made his triumphant return at number 30 and ran wild on everyone. That being said, it would also be really funny if Brett hobbles down at 27, kind of stumbles in the aisle, and then Hogan comes out and a check on him, and Brett waves him in like he does at Mania 9. Oh, imagine how much fucking more bitter that old fuck would be now if that happened. And the whole tease around Brett is really something too. He had his leg kicked out from under his leg earlier in the night. Then there's a spot where no one comes out. It's really great drama. And all they had to do was sacrifice a Bastion Booger appearance to do it, which is fine because I'm not sure anyone has ever been happy to see Bastion Booger waddling down in that gray K-string, including his immediate family. And then the whole setup, like earlier too, got like nuclear heat for Owen Hart on his entrance. Sure, the match gets you the country star who's in there for a minute and does nothing. You get the race car driver who's in there forever and does nothing. But we get to see the birth of the diesel push. And Big Kev comes in and dominates like no one before him. He tosses guy after guy, and the crowd gets more and more behind him. He also kind of saves the match, as until his entrance and his beast mode, the crowd was kind of dead. Without him, I don't know if the match recovers. And I love that as Diesel throws Scott Steiner out, he flips over and kicks Bart Gunn in the head, who's sitting at ringside. Now, no doubt, Scott Steiner probably beat up both Billy and Bart backstage for being in his way. I'll always love, too, that Diesel's run kind of culminates with him eliminating Virgil as DiBiase, like, laughs quietly on commentary. And fuck Jeff Jarrett's headband. Fuck him. It's like he saw himself in the 50 Shades of Suspenders and said, nope, not stupid enough looking. Convince McMahon was in full force trying to sell us on the impending Adam Bomb victory. My favorite elimination, though, is Bam Bam potentially injuring Doink and ending his career by throwing him halfway up the aisle. I also love that Crush and Diesel step back and let Bigelow handle it like a solidarity between the heels. And I mean, who am I kidding about ending Doink's career? They would have just slapped that paint and sadness over someone else. And I'd be remiss, too, if I didn't mention how great Shawn Michaels was. Which we covered extensively on Now Entering the Royal Rumble, JT and I. That runs every other Monday with this show in the North-South Connection. JT and I are breaking down every individual performance in Royal Rumble history. So if you're looking for a trip down the Rumble memory lane, it's totally the show for you. We deep dive into everyone from Hulk Hogan to Danny Davis. And so far, we've listed not only the greatest single performances of all time, but we also do a cumulative score for each guy. And we're seeing who the greatest performer in the history of the event is. It's a crazy project. We've been chugging along every other Monday with this show. The ending of this match, too, is it's great. It's got the three most over guys in the match and Fatu toughing it out. A unique end to a fun match. And then, look, before we go any further, let's deal with my most hated part of this Rumble. I don't think anyone explained to Tenryu what the concept of a bounty was. There was at least three times where he watched Lex Luger almost get eliminated and didn't bother to help. On top of that, he looked completely lost out there. He wanders around aimlessly in the ring. He's looking all confused and sad, as if he's longing for Katao. Easily the most confused participant in the history of the Royal Rumble. You're just there to get Lex Luger out. Focus on that, then do your fucking wandering around and whatever other stuff you're doing. It doesn't make any sense. Next category is historical importance. JT and I ranked it 13th out of 36 on No Holds Barred, which runs twice a month on Saturdays on the North-South Connection podcast network. We're currently breaking down on one of the Saturdays. We are breaking down the best performer from each month of the calendar year. So far, we have named Mr. January, February, March, April, and May. June is upcoming. Last year, we did with the best show of every month. We ranked those. So it's kind of a ranking show, but we do. I like to think it's fun. We're comparing a lot of guys, stuff like that. Our other day of the month, we are starting a new project soon that I think will be a lot of fun. Have an ear out for it because I think it's going to be a really cool one. And that shares Saturdays with JT's Mailbag, which is always great, taking questions from the listeners. And from Squared Circle to Silver Screen, Cowboy and Logan, they just tackled They Live, which is, look, it's They Live. It's not the greatest movie ever, but they kicked ass. They chewed bubble gum. They nailed it. Listen, Saturdays are kicking. Me and JT or JT's Mailbag or from Squared Circle to Silver Screen. You can't go wrong. All right, historical importance. I think this is where they finally went all in on Bret Hart and the smaller guys. This leads to guys like Shawn Michaels and really later leads to guys like Steve Austin getting a shot. And it kind of starts here with Bret being pushed to the moon in 94. Plus, it gives us also a smaller, credible challenger in Owen Hart. And this might be, in part, due to the fact that Vince was nearly placed rightfully behind bars for the distribution of steroids. And I never, he's one of these things, I never understood why so many people felt the need to defend this man. I know he gave us a lot of entertainment, but I'm sure Vince would never be caught on camera or in writing telling guys to get on steroids. But Jesus Christ, I mean, he invited the doctor backstage who prescribed all that shit. And all the guys he pushed for the previous 10 years were juiced to the gills. So, yeah, you can say he technically didn't give anybody steroids. But he certainly created an atmosphere that if you wanted to be well paid for the sacrifices you're putting your body through, you need steroids to get that big. He's not innocent on steroids, and he's not innocent on the deaths based on his insane schedule. He forced guys to work for years. He's not innocent of either of those things. He's just not guilty in a court of law. That's it. Just like OJ, not guilty. And that's why wrestling's so conflicting for me, because I'm clearly addicted to it. So much so that I look past this obviously psychotic man. And yeah, I said psychotic, because you have to be psychotic to either be able to live with yourself after all the deaths, and worse, to be able to say, well, you know, I didn't do anything. They didn't die when they were under, like, they didn't die under our contract. You know, like, come on. But remember, guys, he's the victim. Vince is the victim of the bullying. We need to stand up for WWE. This is kind of what I tied into with Rocco. Like, look at the victim complex this guy has, this billionaire has. Importance, too, it also kicks off the new generation marketing campaign, which will color the next few years with Diesel winning the title. First ladder match creates the company's favorite go-to gimmick. Fouls Count Anywhere debuts on pay-per-view. So there's a lot going on. The SummerSlam. I have this 12th out of 34. There is zero conceivable reason for anyone, but especially a man like Bam Bam Bigelow, to team up with IRS. In fact, if my manager suggested I do such a thing, I would fire him on the spot. They fight the Cowboys in a perfectly fine match, in which only one guy isn't wearing fucking pants, you know? And the one guy wearing wrestling gear is dressed like a great ball of fire. Man, I can only imagine what they do to Bam Bam's ass if, like, he was still alive for that pay-per-view in 2017. Blaze and Naka 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 No have a very good match. And I'm glad I get the chance to talk about the Intercontinental title match here with Diesel defending against Razor Ramon, because this is pure spectacle and I loved it. I have it at 3.75 stars, but I could easily be convinced to bump it up to 4. Both guys are game, but Shawn Michaels on the outside is a force of nature. I guess that's why, I think it was something Ryan said earlier, I don't mind that he wasn't wrestling, because he's basically wrestling in this match. The speed with which he cheats is incredible. And I love the moment where he baits Walter Payton on one side and then runs around the whole ring and jumps off the stairs and nails Ramon with the clothesline. And then Payton finally does get his hands on him just as he's about to break up the final pin that Michaels himself caused with the sweet chin music. The match was fun. It pushed HBK Diesel forward and put the title back where it belonged on Razor's waist. And he got the sellout match. It totally should have been Lex Luger turning heel. I mean, why on earth? I guess you don't want to put him with DiBiase. Neither would I. Tatanka just couldn't handle the role. He wasn't good at the dialogue. Lex, you sold out. Lex, you sold out. Bad match, bad turn, bad manager. Yee, 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 yee. Yee, 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 yee. Money, 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 money. Money. Jared and Mabel fight for 5 minutes longer than they had any business being in the room together. And then Bret and Owen have the thing in the cage that I mentioned off the top. Now, first, I love the idea that both guys are just trying to win by escape. Yes, they were in it. There was hate in the feud. But at least both guys were jumping up to try and escape and win the title. Especially Owen. There wasn't the usual, like, he wants to punish him or teach him a lesson. It's great. The spots are good. Both guys are at the top of their game. Now the problem, though, because there is a bit of a problem with the match. It's too long for me. It goes nearly 33 minutes, and I think it would have been better served being closer to 20. Instead of doing 30 escape attempts, they could have done 15. It would have given the same story. Nothing would have been worse for it. It would have been more concise. Because there's too much repetition of the same spots. And as a consequence for me, the match drags a bit. Now, I still have it at 4 stars, so it's not like I hate it. right? But I think we're sitting on a potential five-star match that got kind of derailed by hubris. That being said, the suplex off the top will always be sublime. Just a word, too, on Davey Boy Smith sitting at ringside with mean Jim Neidhart behind him. I always got the impression that Davey Boy here looks like someone who's not comfortable wearing human clothes. Like, nothing he's wearing makes sense here. It's the wild hair and the glasses. It makes him look like a, you know, like if you've ever seen like a cartoon where like a barbarian drinks like some sort of intelligence serum. That's what I imagine this guy to be in his cut off shirt, cut off vest and fucking beige pants. You're not your fucking cockies, Davey. You're not your fucking cockies. Then the Undertakers have what I consider to be the third worst match in company history. And far and away the worst match, the worst main event the company's ever done. I think it's a good show with a terrible ending. No idea why they didn't want to end with the cage. I guess the Undertaker was bigger for them. Send the people home with some dignity. Someone who always has dignity, Chad Campbell, who joins JT every other Thursday on the Wrestling War Zone. Their trip down the Monday Night War era is prestige listening. And they are now deep into the summer of 1996. Farouk and Miro are tearing it up. There's a leprechaun on the other channel. Hey, look, give it a listen to see why this is considered like a golden age. And that runs in tandem. It's coming back soon. ECW three-way dance. JT, John D'Amato, and Jenny Smith. Three of my favorite people. Kicking it old school with old ECW. They're doing a great job. I know. I haven't listened because I don't want anything spoiled. But, you know, with the people involved, I know it's awesome. And don't forget, Matt Souza and Sean Kidd have started breaking down Impact Wrestling. And I think that's a great addition. Because I kind of appreciate the little resurgence Impact is kind of having right now. I think it's really good. And Matt and Sean kill it. So give them a shot if you get a chance. Okay, let's deal with the worst show of the year. And that is the King of the Ring. And it's not even bad. I mean, the tournament's a lot of fun. Owen's a great winner. Ramon's a really great runner-up. Hell, even Jim Neidhart is the most interesting he's been since he stuffed that ass into those clown pants. The problem is the show is plagued by very short matches. And IRS gets two matches. In fact, every single time that IRS has ever gotten two matches on pay-per-view, that pay-per-view has been named the worst of the year by me. But come on, two? I can barely stand one. Brett and Diesel have a very good match to launch their three-match series. I say three because I want to act like the cage match never happened. Best match on the show is Owen Hart and 123 Kid. Fantastic. Easily the best four-minute match up until that point. Although now I think it has some pretty fierce competition from Goldberg and Brock from WrestleMania 33. But it's a great sprint with really the two best sprinters in the company. Oh yeah, and I mean, I said that was the best match, but you know, that's not the best part of the show. The best part of the show is Art fucking Donovan. Man, just an all-time performance from Art O'Donnell here. Fun fact, the day I got the WWE Network for the first time, the very first show I watched was this, because I'd never seen it from start to finish. My video store didn't have it. And Art did not disappoint.
How much does fella weigh? Hey guys, how much does he weigh?
Regardless of what the weight was, whenever he said, oh, okay. It's just so good. Who's the fella in the white? I can only imagine Vince throwing his headset down as Art failed to identify Shawn Michaels. That's Shawn Michaels, Art Donovan, who's one of the most pushed wrestlers on the last few years. Oh, is that the fella's second? Uttering a word that had never been uttered on wrestling pay-per-view before. He also lamented the weight differences. Oh, that's not fair. I always wondered at what point of the night did the company realize that they had made a huge mistake giving this guy a microphone. I know it was way before Gorilla and Savage started outright ignoring him. At one point, he turns to him and goes, and you guys used to love doing this? And Gorilla looks at him and then turns to Savage and goes, do you think Jim the Anvil Neidhart? There's no way the camera was supposed to be on them. But he clearly heard him and pivoted away. And look, this is not to shit on Art Donovan. This is my favorite commentary performance since Bobby Heenan at the 1992 Royal Rumble. I wish they had him there the next year. It might have added some fun to like an otherwise dreadful and horrible show. All right, let's hear from my pal Michael DeDamos. I don't think I've heard of him on this show. I don't think I've heard from him on this show before. So Michael, thanks for writing in. He goes, 94 in the WWF. I think mostly of Owen's King of the Ring victory. I really didn't expect Owen to win it the year after Brett. Between that and his win over Brett at Mania 10, Owen had a great year. That was the probably the best year he had. I would agree. I would agree with you, Michael. Thanks for writing in. All right, the best show. You know, statistically, I had it as a tie between WrestleMania and the Survivor Series. I'm going to call it for Mania, though, since, you know, but because I think it's a better show. But since we already talked about it, let's talk about the Survivor Series. I think the opener's fun between the bad guys and the Teamsters. They're all in on Diesel as he eliminates the entire team before Sean kicks him in the face again. Enough is enough. We're off and running with Diesel power. I think it's the next matchup can be summed up like this. So, Doink gets eliminated, leaving Dink, Wink, and Pink to fight Lawler and company. And Vince McMahon, in probably, I would assume, the same tone that he used when he told Stephanie and Shane that he cheated on their mom, he goes, "Oh no, the unthinkable has happened." Doink being eliminated is the unthinkable? Pearl Harbor was the unthinkable. Phil Hartman being murdered was unthinkable. You know what's not unthinkable? The most loathsome gunt in the promotion being eliminated from a match in which he's not only the focal point, but has a smaller set of clones surrounding the ring. You can't say things are unthinkable when your actual catchphrase is, "Anything can happen in the WWF." Anything but Doink being eliminated from a Survivor Series match? Anything but that? Then Backlund wins the title. Lex Luger beats the Million Dollar Team. Oh, wait. No, that's what should have happened. Of course, it's Lex Luger. So, I mean, why would he be winning matches on pay-per-view? It's not enough that he had to tie with the cripple at the Rumble and then get beat by Yoko at Mania. No, and not wrestle the King of the Ring and lose to fucking Tatanka at SummerSlam. No, 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 no. We got to team him with the Grape and the Cowboys and the Human Radiation Guy as a team. A team of fucking losers. All they've done all year long is lose. All they've done all year long is lose. But Lex can pull it out, right? Against a team where the gigolo Jimmy Del Rey is a member? Nope. Bam Bam and Bundy needed to win here. Fuck you, Lex. Grow out your hair and team with Davey Boy the Barbarian going forward, all right? I don't know why they hated Lex Luger so much. I guess my thought is he defecated all over that damn bus. Then Taker and Yoko have their best match, and Jeff Jarrett, of all people, gets kicked in the face by Chuck Norris. I feel like Jarrett was chosen because he probably didn't make Chuck Norris look short. Anyways, despite my insane ramblings, I think it's a great show. But yeah, easily give it to Mania. If there's ever been, I mean, there's a lot of evidence. My systems are flawed, but this is one of them. All right, Dennis Nunez. Let's do some comments, then best wrestler, worst wrestler. Out of here. Dennis Nunez. Ah, 1994. Jim Carrey was the hottest star in Hollywood. The Simpsons were in their absolute prime. The Disney rebirth had reached its peak with The Lion King. And The Undertaker floated above everyone at the Royal Rumble. Okay, maybe that last one was a fail, but 1994 WWF on pay-per-view was a very strong year. Despite the Undertaker floatiness at the Rumble, he and Yokozuna had a very good chemistry together, and Taker wouldn't have with anyone else until his feud with Mankind. Eh, interesting take. Diesel kicking ass at the Rumble match is always fun to see, especially if it planted the seed in Vince's head to make Diesel the guy. WrestleMania 10 is kind of a two-match show. Yeah, but again, but both matches are excellent, and the rest of the show is at least fun to watch. So then it's not a two-match show. Like, I mean, I'm not saying this for Dennis, but for any... Like, if the rest of the show is good, it's not a two-match show. I think if you're going to say something's a two-match show, like, two matches need to be great and everything else needs to be shit, right? But again, I said the same thing. I'm just kind of unpacking this more for myself. But if the rest is good, it's just a good show. Sorry, back to Dennis. The show is at least fun to watch. I also like the WrestleMania Moments video throughout the... Oh, yeah, those are fun, too. You're right. Fun fact... King of the Ring 94 took place the weekend of O.J. Simpson's Bronco chase. Hey, Gorilla, who's the guy in the white Bronco? I'm assuming you wanted it done in Art Donovan's voice. The Bret Owen cage match from SummerSlam is probably better than their Mania match. Dennis. okay, all right. Well, I know that's kind of a hot take, but I really enjoy it. And I think it's the match that keeps building the tension throughout. Oh, fair enough. Owen already beat Bret clean at Mania, so he's got nothing to prove. He just wants to win the belt, which is why there's so much of him trying to climb out of the cage fast throughout the match. It's excellent psychology and makes the match hold up to this day. I agree, it's excellent psychology. I couldn't go as far as saying it's better than Mania, but, you know, to each their own. The two takers was weird and sucked. All the heels being scared of Chuck Norris at Survivor Series makes total and complete sense. Hell, I wouldn't fuck with him either. James Grunberg. the Year of Hearts mixed in with Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon ladder match, and Bob Backlund losing to Diesel in 11 seconds and a Chuck Norris appearance got you a solid year.
Yeah. All right, Ryan Everett, who also sent me the Krusty the Clown.
Talk to the audience. Oh, this is always death. Well, here we go, Ryan. And no, I didn't edit it, Ryan, if you're wondering. All right, here we go. But really, 1994 was probably the apex of my fandom because it was still kind of cool to eight-year-olds. But by the end of the year, it was out for Power Rangers. So I had to go into sleeper mode until I could just, well, actually, everyone that Steve Austin awesome in WCW in 1998. He's not a new guy. Yeah. See, I don't edit myself either. So you'll see as I get to the end of this. He's like, if you edit it, if you want. Ryan, but I don't edit myself, so everything is just here. Rumble 1994. I wonder which Undertaker match gets your worst spot, and I hope it involves Brian Lee, who can never pass for The Undertaker. She can. The Rumble match shows that Yoko Taker had great chemistry for the first 10 minutes, are fun, and then all the heels come down to help the heel champ win. And then The Undertaker ascended to heaven. What's so goofy about that? Why are we assuming he went to heaven? All right, back to Ryan. Rumble match itself is really good with Kevin Nash supposedly saving his job and coincidentally changing the business. In the first, dominant badass controls the Rumble match. I love DiBiase's reaction as Virgil comes to the ring. Yeah, me too. WrestleMania, Owen Brett and the ladder match are classics, but at the time watching Scramble Vision, I watched a lot of that too, I thought the Macho Crush match was best. So much that I talked my parents into letting me call the Superstars line to talk with Randy Savage. Hearing a pre-recorded Can Macho promo may have killed my innocence. Hey, two people's innocence he killed that weekend. King of the Ring, how much does this guy weigh? Hey, Randy, who this guy with the American flag on his pants? I love how Savage would pitch the company line each time, like, oh, you know, that's the old American Lex Luger, and he's coming out here because he's got a problem with the Turncoat Crush. Oh, okay. SummerSlam. Until like 5 years ago, when I could actually look at the show as a show, I've always hated this SummerSlam because my dad hated driving to the Rosemont Horizon and would always say they should hold their shows at the Chicago Stadium. It's downtown. But then we couldn't get tickets to the event in the brand new United Center. Love the Diesel Razor match because of having Walter Payton. Made my dad care, and he usually couldn't give a shit. I love those moments, right, Ryan? Like, me, it was I guess it's 88, 89, when Rugged Ronnie Garvin showed up. My dad loved Rugged Ronnie Garvin. And it's like, I don't know why, you know. I guess it's because he must have seen him wrestle when he was a kid or something. But, like, it's so fun when, like, something pulls our parents in. All right, back to Ryan. Maple Jeff Jarrett is a match that happened despite Doink feuding with Jarrett from, like, May to October. Survivor Series, unfortunate last Thanksgiving Eve tradition. Had a Boy Scout meeting that night since we didn't have school the next day. Ended early because some kid stuffed 3 cotton balls up his nose during a make your own table center craft. Was he making it out of cotton? And I was happy because I'd be able to watch Scramble Vision for the world title match. And sorry, that match is about as interesting in crystal clear 1080 HD on the glorious Peacock as it is in Scramble Vision. Oh, we got a non-fan. That's all right. I understand. I didn't like it for the longest time. All right. I really like the opener and again, like Yoko Taker. And then Ryan concludes with, I know these are rambling and any edits will be understood, but I got high on Friday afternoon. Oh, I love you, Ryan. You're the best. Thank you so much for writing in. And please take my laughter as it's intended, not as I'm making fun of you, but just enjoying your writing. All right, 5 worst wrestlers. Number 5, Lex Luger, uninspired at the Rumble despite the win. All-time bad with Yoko at Mania despite his referee pants. Lost at Tatanka despite logic and a very good match in Survivor Series. It's not his fault. Luger can be a world-class worker when they needed him, but they never put him in a position to succeed. Where's the match with Brett, with Owen, with Diesel or Shawn? What about Backlund, Razor? He never had anything with any of these people. What a waste of what could have been a really great run. He's great with Lex, with Ric Flair. Put him in there with fucking Shawn. All right. Number 4, Doink. We know why this fucker's here. Don't even ask me questions about it. Number 3, Dink. We know why this little fucker's here. Don't even ask me any questions about it. Number 2, Jerry Lawler. Imagine how bad the number one wrestlers you had to be for Lawler not to win here. He's got the bullshit with Piper, the unthinkable atrocity of the Survivor Series. See, that's unthinkable, all right? That not only would there be a Jerry Lawler and Doink feud, but we dress up three people like Doink and three like Lawler, and of the six people, only one of them has a proper name, and that's Dink. Imagine Dink is the best name. Dink! As a name. The rest have adjectives for names. Pink, cheesy, sleazy, queasy. Wink has a verb for a name. For going with verbs, I wish either Doink or Dink had been called Dump. Then we could have Doink and Dump or Dump and Dink. If we're going to dehumanize these guys, go all the way. Doink, Dump, Lump, Frump. The worst wrestler of the year. The Undertaker. He dies at the Rumble. In his own gimmick match, no less. He must have a losing record in these matches. He fights Brian Lee at SummerSlam, and then, fuck, you know, it's a, come on, you know it's a bad year for him. 92 to 95 are all bad years for him. All right, five best wrestlers. Number five, the 1-2-3 Kid. He makes it because of a tie. But he also makes it on the strength of the Owen Hart match at the Rumble, which is paired nicely with the boring match with Double J. But he's one of the bad guys. He gets credit for that. It's a shame we're not covering TV because he gets some love for the Bret Hart match. And hell, here's another guy Luger could have fought and had a really interesting contest with. All right, number four is a tie. Tie between Diesel. So Diesel helped make the Rumble great. Had a very good match with Bret. A fantastic spectacle with Ramon. And then a really dominant showing at the Survivor Series. Dominant the Rumble, dominant Survivor Series. At the time, it's funny. You know, at the time I thought, you know, his title win comes out of nowhere. But looking back, I think as of that Rumble, they're all in. He's pretty compelling, interesting character all year. The storyline with Shawn is really solid. It's a good slow build. I really respect his work this year. He's tied for number four with Razor Ramon. I'm giving Razor the nod a little bit on top for having the ladder match at Mania. You can even forgive the IRS match because of the greatest of all time match there. But Razor was special in 1994. And again, he doesn't get the credit for how great he was in the era. And while we're laughing at Art Donovan, and I love how, like, who's going to win, Art? Razor Ramon, from the start. He really helped establish Owen Hart, too, in that tournament. Number three, Shawn Michaels. Now, that's weird, right? Like, he's in three matches, but they're all excellent. So, I give him credit. So, when I rank these Rumbles, if a Rumble cracks four stars for me, I can give up to four people credit for the match. So, that counts towards their score. That's something I've always done for the Rumbles. I don't have to give four, but I can give up to four if I think they've impacted the match. So for the number 94 Rumble, I gave the four people. I only gave three. I gave to Diesel, Brett, and Shawn. Because I thought Shawn really anchored the Rumble. He basically works a match at SummerSlam with with Walter Payton. He's the centerpiece of the Teamsters. And then the ladder match. So I also think this is the first year that Shawn Michaels feels like a big deal. Whereas before, he really still felt like the mid, like just a mid-card guy. Now he's starting to feel like an upper mid-card. Number two, Owen Hart. So breakout year that forever made Owen, which is great because I loved Owen. Owen was my favorite wrestler for a while during this period, and I loved him. Nice, really heat-filled match with the Quebecers at the Rumble. All-time turn. Best opening match ever to that point, maybe still today. King of the Ring run, which, I mean, you know, you can say what you want about the match quality, but it was entertaining to see him go on that run. The cage match, the crocodile tears to top it off. And I think the best part of all this was that, like, Owen was just he was legit main eventer this year because they did it right and they built him right. And his heat was off the charts, right? And no kidding, because his performances always rose to the occasion. This is probably the best year of his career. And something I love is reading Bret Hart's book. It's really clear how much they both enjoyed it. And I'm really happy that, you know, just person to person, that these two brothers who clearly loved each other got to have this thing that they worked on and created this really great thing that we still cherish today. Not only was it great, because Rocco, you're asking, like, if you love what you do, you don't feel like you work a day in your life, right? There's no way Owen and Bret felt like they were working when they were working with each other. And it's awesome. So, number one wrestler of the year. I mean, come on. Who can it be now? It's got to be Bret Hart. The only match I have him in that doesn't crack four stars this year is the Diesel match at King of the Ring. And I think I'm low on it, right? On the last episode, I also talked, which was 91, I talked about how I didn't feel Bret was there yet as a character. And I think in 92, he's not quite there yet in terms of credibility. Here, he's the guy in the promotion. This is Brett's company. And he's this, and they, look, it might be because people have left, but it doesn't matter because he's competent and he's credible. He's the standard bearer so much that when he wins at WrestleMania 10, it feels right. In this new era where match quality was king, Brett's going to excel. He was exactly the right guy to go in this direction with, and 1994 proves it in spades. I can't say enough good things about Bret Hart here. He's undoubtedly the best there was in 1994, and this year ranks as one of the best for him that ever will be. So, 1994 finishes seventh on the strength of its Mania, Characters, Mid-Card, and Royal Rumble. What's astonishing is that it's the only top five finish it has in any category is in the mid-card. But here's the deal. The worst finish is the tag team in the matches at 21st. So that's out of 36, that's a really good average. Like, everything is, like, pretty above average. And then two things are just a bit below average, right? And what's crazy is 94 only finishes 5.5 points out of fifth or 9 points out of fourth. So imagine if those tag team title changes had happened on pay-per-view. Maybe we're looking at a top four finish, which seems crazy to me. The matches are fun in the year. The only really awful thing is two Undertakers. IRS is kept to a minimum. It's great. And I think at the time, I was growing out of the product, which is kind of sad because it was clearly aimed at my 14-year-old self. It was making an effort to keep my attention. And it's a shame that I was too worried about self-image and being liked to just go all in and appreciate it. And I think it's actually a really good lesson that, like, you should always just like what you like, because, you know, who cares what anybody else thinks about what you like? If it's something that brings you joy, then why not go for it? Why not have the most joy you can have? Next time on The Year That Was, the sixth greatest year in WWF history, which follows the trend of the product growing up with us. Like, the matches in this year are in the toilet, but the characters are some of the most memorable of all time, proving that almost definitively that characters and storylines are what pushes the WWF to its greatest heights. See you then.